Hi, and welcome to the Nat Decants podcast. I'm your wine-soaked host, Natalie McLean. Whatever your opinion on global warming, it's certainly a hot topic these days. But how would climate change affect wine? I hope you find the discussion of these issues helpful today. But before we get to the story, I'd like to tell you about this week's delicious recipe for pork tenderloin with a black currant Cabernet reduction. It comes from executive chef Sean Zarin of DeBars Manor Inn, an 1837 historic inn on the seacoast village of Guysborough, Nova Scotia. I'd pair this dish with the 2005 Ayrshires Max Reserva Merlot from Chile from our May 22nd wine picks on the website at nataliemclean.com. I agonized over which of Sean's recipes to highlight this week because they all sounded so mouthwateringly great, including his pan-seared halibut with a leek Pommeray reduction sauce, which I'd pair with the 2006 Jackson Estate Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand from the May 26th wine picks, now posted. I'd match his lobster cakes with mango rhubarb salsa with the 2006 Calatira Arboledita Chardonnay from Chile from the June 9th wine picks. Oh my goodness, I'm so hungry. You can search for more recipes for hors d'oeuvres, appetizers, entrees, breads, and desserts now on the site. And if you'd like to submit recipes to be featured in this podcast and in the newsletter with credits to you and your company, please email me at natdecants@nataliemclean.com. We have two wine words to mention this week. The first word of the week is fat. And this is a descriptor that usually refers to the texture of a wine that is smooth, round, and slippery on your palate. Often these wines are high in glycerin, low in acidity, and generous in their fruit flavors. In the wine world, fat is usually a positive term, and I like that. The second word is open. This describes a wine that's ready to drink, often because it's been decanted. A process of opening up the wine by exposing it to oxygen. I also think of many people as open, especially around 5 p.m. when they're ready to drink. You can find more definitions in my wine glossary on nataliemclean.com. And the question of the week is, with so many choices and combinations, is there a quick and easy way that I can match food and wine? You really can drink wine with just about anything. Zinfandel with your Tex-Mex? Not a problem. A little Chardonnay with your fried chicken takeout? Delicious. Pinot Noir and wild boar or champagne and potato chips? Why not? I've included them all in my new interactive matching tool at nataliemclean.com/matcher. The old rules about white wine and white meat and red wine and red meat just don't give us enough guidance anymore. With modern fusion cuisine and wines from new regions around the world, the choices and confusion are great. The matching tool pairs wines with everyday meals, as well as challenging fare such as vegetarian cuisine, egg-based sauces, cheese, TV dinners, and even dessert, including Jell-O and fudge for those who like to layer their vices. You can simply search for wine, or you can search by wine for meal inspirations or by food to find great wine choices. There are more than 360,000 food and wine combinations in the matcher, as well as thousands of recipes for a variety of dishes. I add more wines and foods based on suggestions from subscribers to my e-newsletter, and I also write about food and wine matching for dinner parties in my new book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over. With barbecue season around the corner, you'll find suggestions for grilled meats and vegetables, as well as summer salads and seafood. If you're planning weddings, reunions, or graduation parties, you can discover great suggestions for a wide range of menus, so enjoy. Although I can't answer all of the emails I receive, about several hundred a day, I do try to answer as many as I can in the frequently asked questions section of my site. And in Red, White, and Drunk All Over, I also tackle many aspects of wine from grape to glass, how wine is made, marketed, matched with food, consumed and cellared. And I do this through storytelling, taking my readers behind the scenes of the international wine world, visiting its most evocative places, and sharing adventures with some of its most colorful and hilarious personalities. If you'd like to find out more, you can read both media and reader reviews of the book on the site. As usual, if you'd like to find out more about upcoming wine events, wines to buy, and other newsy bits and gossip that are part of my free e-newsletter, you can sign up for it at nataliemaclean.com. And if you have any comments or suggestions, just send me an email. And now, sit back, pour yourself a glass of something, and enjoy this week's story entitled Drinking, The Day After Tomorrow. Château Loch Ness is a crisp white from northern Scotland with hints of windswept heather and briny ocean spray. It pairs beautifully with haggis and shortbread. That sounds far-fetched now, but in half a century it could become quite commonplace. British researchers have established that if global warming continues at its current rate, wine grapes could be grown that far north by 2050. Glaswegian Gamay or Siberian Sauvignon, anyone? The Earth's climate has fluctuated for centuries, but scientists believe that it has never before shown such a steady or rapid increase in temperature. 9 of the 10 hottest years on record have occurred since 1990, according to Tim Flannery in his book, The Weathermakers. The heat is even a premise for children's movies now. The sequel to Ice Age was subtitled The Meltdown. The main culprit is carbon dioxide. According to viticulture professor Snow Barlow from Australia's University of Melbourne, worldwide levels of carbon dioxide have risen faster in the past 100 years than in the previous 900. If warming continues at that rate, Barlow predicts that Australian grape harvest dates could be 3 weeks earlier in another 50 years. Earlier harvests have already been observed in France. Aubert de Villaine, winemaker for the famed Burgundy Romani Conti, notes that harvest dates have moved back by about a week per decade since the 1970s. Grapes are now picked in mid-September, and the heat wave that swept Europe in the summer of 2003 had many vintners wondering if that weather was just an anomaly or part of a larger trend. Temperatures that summer were 7.7 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than previous seasonal averages. Would slightly warmer temperatures be good for grapes? It certainly seems so for climates such as Germany, Canada, and northern France, where vintners struggle to coax ripeness out of grapes that often don't get enough sunshine. However, the effect could be reversed for warm areas, such as Spain, Portugal, and Italy, that already produce ripe grapes. Those regions could become too hot, and the fruit would over-ripen, loaded with natural sugars. During fermentation, yeast would convert those concentrated sugars into much higher levels of alcohol. In 2003, Italian wines reached staggering alcohol levels of 16%, while drought reduced yields by 20%. Even in France, dry conditions severely reduced yields in Bordeaux, Burgundy, and the Loire Valley. In both warm and cool regions, one result would be the same. Wines would lose their traditional character, no longer tasting as they have for hundreds of years, and well-entrenched identities would vanish. Understanding how global warming works can help to clarify its complex weave of influences on the wine industry. The basic principle is that the Earth's atmosphere lets in visible sunlight and invisible light waves. The Earth's atmosphere, land masses, and oceans absorb most of this radiation. However, when it strikes surface ice or clouds, some of it reflects back out into space. The atmosphere slows this escaping radiation, thereby keeping the Earth warm. Without this protection, our planet would be an icy minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit. The atmosphere works like a glass of a greenhouse. It allows heat in, but doesn't let much out. Water vapor and carbon dioxide are the main atmospheric elements that trap radiation heat, which is why they're called greenhouse gases. This heat exchange system worked just fine for millions of years, until people started screwing it up. Starting with the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century, humans began burning fossil fuels such as coal, oil, and gas on a large scale, contributing significantly to carbon dioxide levels. Today, our fuel consumption has skyrocketed with the widespread use of cars, SUVs, airplanes, factories, central heating, air conditioners, and all other conveniences of modern life. Scientists and environmentalists have been warning for years about the dangers of unchecked carbon dioxide emissions. The difficulty is getting countries to agree on what to do. One moderate success has been the 2005 Kyoto Protocol, an agreement among 162 countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 5% by 2010. Whether this is enough or soon enough remains to be seen. Climatologists can't describe precisely the potential climate change. It's difficult enough to predict what will happen in just a few days, as any meteorologist will tell you. It's almost impossible to forecast climate change over decades or centuries. For example, climatologists know that 10,000 years ago, the Gulf Stream, the ocean current from the south that warms northern Europe, shut off temporarily, plunging Europe into the last ice age. The theory is that global warming could melt the remaining Arctic ice cap, raising sea levels worldwide. However, global warming isn't going to happen uniformly. Temperature variations are wider at the poles than at the equator. The United Nations also predicts that by the end of the 21st century, winters will be wetter, summers will be drier, and there'll be more violent weather extremes, including a tenfold increase in heat waves. The organization also believes that average summer temperatures could increase by 7 to 12% or degrees Fahrenheit and winter temperatures by 3 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Just 2 degrees of increased warmth correlates with a 112-mile shift northward for the viable grape-growing range. Changes in temperature and rainfall also affect which plants thrive where. Grapevines are extremely sensitive to climate change, reacting to even the smallest variations in their surroundings. Vintner's folklore tells of a tale of one vineyard producing wine with faint aromas of tar when the work crews paved a nearby road. That may be a myth, but it's well known that grapes grown on east-facing slopes exposed to gentle morning sunlight produce more complex wines than those made from grapes grown with a western orientation and the hot afternoon sun. That environmental sensitivity also shows itself in other ways. Too much heat sends grape sugars soaring, washes out their red color, and can even make a plant shut down completely if it gets hot enough, around 98 degrees Fahrenheit. Like all plants, vines need water to survive, but too much will dilute the grapes and produce bland wines. A lot of rainfall means rot. The harm from one bad season lingers into the next one. The shoots, where next year's grapes will grow, form during the fall, and the life cycle varies according to the vine's memory of last year's weather. Wine flavors are created when grapes absorb nutrients and minerals from the soil. As the grapes grow, they're influenced by warmth, rainfall, and wind. Grapes ripen in about 40 to 60 days after the fruit emerges, through a process called veraison. The grapes start as hard green pellets that slowly soften, sweeten, and take on their final color. Heat lowers their acidity as their sugar increases. The tannins and flavors in the skins mature, a slow process that depends more on time than heat, and growers sometimes wait several weeks to pick in the fall, just as that process peaks. Ideally, all of the grape's elements, sugars, acids, tannins, and flavors are mature at harvest. However, many things can affect this delicate balance. Historically, cool regions such as France experience poor vintages every second or third year, whether that's too much rain or not enough warmth or both. Sometimes, after a heat wave, the grape's sugars can peak before the other flavors have matured, resulting in fruity sweet wines. If grapes are left on the vine too long, waiting for those other flavors, they lose much of their acidity, a necessary element for balanced, structured, and food-friendly wines. A moderate amount of acidity prevents the wine from tasting flabby, like lemonade, without any tartness to balance its sweetness, or from overwhelming the flavors of a dish. Acidity is also a preservative necessary for the long-term aging of wine, and that's why a little more warmth in cool climates wouldn't hurt the grapes. Most nights would still be chilly enough to preserve acidity and fresh fruit flavors. Wine grapes are one of the most sensitive barometers of global warming, and its impact would likely be greater on viticulture than many other types of agriculture. Most crops are planted anew every year, but it takes at least 5 years for vines to produce grapes that will make good wine. After that, most vineyards produce for 25 to 50 years, so winemakers must consider the long term when deciding what to plant and how to manage their vineyards. That's why experts are studying the subject and trying to anticipate future trends. The 2005 study called Climate Change and Global Wine Quality by Gregory Jones of Southern Oregon University in Ashland looks at 27 wine regions around the world, comparing weather records with vintage ratings from Sotheby's Wine Auction Department. Their main discovery was that as temperatures have risen an average of 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 50 years, wine quality has improved. However, cooler regions, such as Germany, Champagne, and Oregon, have benefited from increasing temperatures more so than warm regions did, such as Australia and Chile. In cool climates, more warmth meant consistent ripening. In the 1990s, 9 years were declared as vintages, exceptionally good years, for Champagne, compared with 6 in the 1980s and 4 in the 1970s. In Bordeaux, both the 2000 and 2005 vintages were already being described as vintages of the century. In the past 50 years, the northern Rhone Valley has warmed up more than any other French region, by an average of 7.3 degrees Fahrenheit, Jones notes. Côte-Rôti Syrahs from that region, traditionally balanced and elegant, are now compared to blockbuster Australian Shirazes. In 2003, the famed Rhone winemaker Marcel Guigal had to acidify his wines for the first time ever to balance the ripe fruit flavors. Jones believes that Champagne may even start producing still table wine because temperatures will ripen grapes beyond what's required for bubbly. Germany may start growing grapes traditionally grown in France, and Bordeaux may have to specialize in late ripening Cabernet Sauvignon, which can take the heat better than early ripening Merlot. Both grapes are part of Bordeaux blends now. Of course, more factors than just warmer temperatures are contributing to that kind of change. Consumer taste, for instance. Many drinkers today prefer bold, big wines with their higher alcohol and heavier, oakier aromas. Many such wines earn high scores from influential critics, such as Robert Parker. Winemakers are also improving their vine growing and winemaking techniques and technology. Some are experimenting with earlier ripening or non-traditional varieties and mapping their vineyards with the help of satellite imagery to optimize the grape to the site. The researchers also found that warmer temperatures were not always good for southern wine regions such as Spain and Portugal, which could suffer temperatures too hot for grape growing. That same principle could soon apply to this continent. In the next 50 years, Jones believes, regions such as California's Napa Valley and Central Valley, already warm, could get enough heat to stress the grapes and decrease their productivity. Although warmer temperatures might help ripen grapes in Germany's cool climate, winemakers there could have difficulty getting the cold required to make their sweet ice wine. Canada, now the world's largest producer of ice wine, could face the same problem. In the chill of winter, grapes by then frozen and hard and to hard brown marbles are typically picked at night in temperatures of 17 degrees Fahrenheit. So that concentrated nectar inside the skins isn't diluted by melting. However, in 1997, Ontario winemakers lost 75% of the crop to El Niño's freakish warming effect, and to marauding starlings that descended on the grapes in black clouds of peckish delight. Warmer and wetter winters in Germany could also mean flooding along the steeply terraced Moselle River. Vineyards there could be washed out or even buried in mudslides. The same problem could arise in France, since many of Bordeaux's most famous vineyards are planted on lands drained in the 17th century with the help of Dutch dike-building experience. If global warming melts the polar ice caps and raises sea levels, some of France's finest chateaux, Latour, Lafitte Rothschild, and Montrose, could be underwater in 50 years. Salt water could also lap at the edges of great vineyards such as Côte d'Esternel, Lioville-la-Casse, Pichon-Lanville, and Descrues-Beaucaillou, and likely submerge them during high tides. In the New World, Carneros, just south of Napa Valley, could be lost, as would some of New Zealand's lower vineyards. Fortunately, some researchers consider such biblical nightmares unlikely. Climatologist Evelyn Browning Garris, based in New Mexico, believes that the greatest danger to farms and vineyards comes not from warmer temperatures or even flooding, but from water scarcity. Southern Portugal and Spain are already experiencing droughts. The Carnegie Institution, a Washington think tank, together with the National Academy of Sciences, has predicted dire news for California agriculture. The region is already highly dependent on irrigation, and so increasing temperatures, including more heat waves, those with 90 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 days or longer, aren't good news. Greater warmth also allows diseases and pests to expand their ranges. For example, the glassy-winged sharpshooter, an insect that helps spread the bacterial-based Pierce's disease, which rots vine leaves, arrived in California in 1989. Oregon was previously too cold for the pest, but it now threatens to attack vines in that region. Such physical and geographic differences also play a big part in tying the identity and style of a wine to a particular region. Alsace and Germany, for instance, both lie at the northern edge of the viable grape-growing latitudes, so they've specialized in early ripening whites, such as Riesling, Gewürztraminer, and Muscat. Their wines are famous for their balance and delicacy, and are part of what gives these regions their unique character. Now the grapes are ripening to greater sweetness than ever before, and some of the region's winemakers no longer find it necessary to chaptalize, add sugar to increase the alcohol content, or reduce its acidity. Germany, long the land of cool climate whites, is starting to become known for Pinot Noir, a red wine. There's no doubt that the winds of change are blowing through the world of wine, but what might be the result? One scientist at the University of Colorado, Robert Pincus, believes that a warmer world will make decades of expertise in winemaking irrelevant. Winemakers may have to plant different grapes in different locations, especially at higher elevations, to achieve historical cool averages. Australian scientists have crossed Cabernet Sauvignon with the little-known Spanish grape that thrives in dry, hot vineyards. Winemaking methods may also change, using technology to lower sugar content and experimenting with genetically modified vines that are drought-resistant. Wine is now being made in such previously unlikely places as Japan, Nepal, and India. Some champagne producers are even planting vines in southern England, searching for the right combination of cool temperatures and low-acid soil. In turn, winemaking laws, particularly in Europe, may have to be revised or rewritten, for example, allowing irrigation in newly drought-stricken areas. Boundaries for regional appellations might have to be redefined. Global warming won't stop us from making or drinking wine. However, technology has given us the false impression that we're impervious to nature, that we can irrigate during a drought, fight disease with chemicals, and plant genetically modified vines to produce or boost production. However, as a warmer world pushes us to the edge of what technology can manage, we'll need to reconsider how we treat the planet. Otherwise, the future may find us sipping on Arctic Chardonnay just to keep our cool. That's it for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let others know about them. There's more info in the book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over, and my free e-newsletter at nataliemaclean.com. Tune in again in another 2 weeks' time for another episode. And in the meantime, drink up. Cheers, Natalie. This podcast and its content are a copyright of Natalie McLean, 2007.